And welcome to the House of Commons podcast, a regular podcast featuring myself, Emma Burnell, a Labour supporting blogger, and my friend Mark Thompson, who is a Liberal Democrats blogger. We're delighted today to be joined by Charlotte Veer, who is a Conservative activist. Hello, Charlotte.
Hello, Emma.
So we thought we'd start today with the hint of revolution in the air. Russell Brand has fired up the troops, fired them up to what purpose, I'm not entirely clear. But he certainly wants something. Mark, did you get a sense from either his article or his interview as to what that something is?
No, I don't think he knows what he wants. He knows what he's against, and that seems to be pretty much anything that you could describe as the status quo. I mean, for anyone who isn't aware of what he said, he basically is calling for a revolution. So he did an interview with Jeremy Paxman, which was off the back of him guest editing an edition of The New Statesman, in which he wrote a very, very, very long, in fact, too long. I'm sure a lot of people did the old too long, didn't read thing on, that you see on forums, just because it was probably about 10 times the length of a normal blog post or a normal article. But I did wade through it, and I did watch the whole of his Newsnight interview. And yeah, he's basically calling for a revolution. He seems to be quite proud of the fact that he doesn't vote, and he has never voted, and he never intends to vote. And yet, despite that, he thinks that, well, his rationale for that is apparently that if you vote, you're complicit in the current system, and therefore, you know, you're taking part in it and you're giving validation to the current system. I mean, I have to say, although I would say there are probably kernels within what he's saying that I would have some identification with. So, you know, there are definitely problems in our current political system. There's no doubt about it. But he just comes across as hopelessly naive. But the thing with Russell Brand is he is very articulate. So he uses all these, you know, fancy long words. And I think he is able to give a good impression of someone who really seems to know what they're talking about, but it's incredibly superficial. And as soon as you look beyond the long words, you realise that there's nothing there. It's just will-o'-the-wisp. It just disappears. Mm. And he really isn't arguing for anything. You know, a lot of what his arguments seem to consist of was, you know, going back to kind of paganistic ways of life, and we need to do what the Celtic peoples have done and the Native American peoples. I don't think he understands what he's talking about, frankly.
Charlotte, how did you feel about it?
I'm afraid I couldn't quite bring myself to watch it. I read about it and I thought, I was reminded of Citizen Smith, of course, and Power to the People, because he does look very much like it, and it's very sweet, and it's very 1970s, and it's a bit sort of revolution from his back bedroom, although, quite frankly, he has many, many millions of pounds, which he hasn't managed to give away yet. But, you know, come the revolution, I'm sure he will get round it. You know, but in the meantime, he's working his way through all the pretty girls in the UK and the US. So I personally decided that actually I don't know why I should have to listen to him. Occasionally I catch him on television. I'm not particularly impressed, long words or not. So I just decided that I didn't really think he had much to say. So I didn't bother, if that's okay.
Fair enough. I mean, I quite enjoy some of his stand-up. I find some of his attitudes, particularly towards women, a bit worrying, and a bit worrying for someone who's now being held up as some sort of hero of the left by some of our more excitable members. But there was nothing there. There was no substance. It was, as Mark said, I mean, I think we're all in danger of agreeing and therefore confirming that we are the status quo. But yeah, I mean, it was, I think there are huge, huge problems inherent in our system. There are huge, huge problems of inequality. If you want to deal with those, you have to have a plan, not just a, well, this shouldn't be the case.
Yeah.
And there was no plan.
But absolutely. But I mean, rejecting the entire political system is incredibly insulting on a lot of different levels. If you think about all the people from all political parties, you know, activists and local councillors and MPs who, you know, who work, you know, week in, week out, year in, year out to get elected and to make a difference to people's lives. You know, all the things that councillors and MPs do to help their constituents find houses and, you know, navigate the, you know, the bureaucracies in order to get things they're entitled to. I mean, you know, it's not all bad. And to listen to Brand, you would think that the entire system is completely broken and there is no value in it at all, and we'd be far better off having basically no government. It's just, it is insulting. And, you know, I think a more measured approach and a more responsible approach would be to recognise that there are definitely problems within the current system and to try and campaign to do something about it, not to just say, well, let's just rip it all up. For a start, it's completely unrealistic and it just isn't going to happen. And it just doesn't get you anywhere. And worst of all, he's encouraging young people, particularly young people, because they're the people who listen to him, not to vote. And that's like the worst advice I can imagine in as regards politics. Because one of the reasons young people are so disenfranchised is because they don't vote in high enough numbers. Yeah. You know, I've talked about this before. You know, one of the reasons why older people tend to get more out of the political system is because politicians are afraid of old people because they vote. You know, the kind of turnout you get from young people, if you know, even a small percentage of them are encouraged to not vote by Brand, he's doing them a massive disservice.
Yes, but just let's remember, I mean, Russell Brand is not stupid. He sat in his Hollywood Sun lounger and the New Statesman called and said, wouldn't it be fun if, and he thought, oh yeah, it would be fun if. And then he decided to spend the next 2 weeks to hone his particular brand of revolution, which he decided to put out there. And as you quite rightly say, Mark, it's extremely divisive. It's not well thought through. It's not the right way that things should be done anyway. I'm really waiting for Mr. Brand to stand for Parliament or Council or indeed stand for anything, because I just think he's been hugely unhelpful. However, it has been a brilliant publicity coup for both him and his failing career and the New Statesman. Congratulations on that for both of them.
I think, to be fair, Charlotte, the reason he said yes is because Jemima Cohn fluttered her eyelashes at him. I don't think it was... He's basically admitted that.
Isn't he seeing her at the moment?
Yeah.
No, they split up.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, you see, we're behind the curve, Charlotte. You have to catch us up on the gossip.
It lasted 4 weeks. They've split up. It's now... He's moved on to someone else. You know, literally working his way through the women of this country.
Well, you know, I'm sure I'm just bitter that it's not my turn yet.
Thankfully, I'm of a different generation, so I'm feeling quite relieved.
I suspect that wouldn't stop him for a moment. Yes, I think we've probably done this one rather to death, because there's so little substance. There's very little to say about it. I mean, it is a shame that someone with so little to say has so many platforms on which to say it, when there are probably plenty of people out there with really interesting, far better ideas, but who don't happen to be celebrities.
Well, yeah, and actually, just while you're on that, we saw a similar dynamic with the whole drugs policy debate. Now, I actually sort of agree with Brand's basic opinion on drugs policy, that it's not right. But he has some, in my view, strange ideas about how to go about things. And some of his, it's clear that he hasn't researched the subject deeply. So he obviously he knows about drugs because he's a recovering addict himself. But when it comes to the kind of options for drugs policy that there are potentially to take forward, he didn't seem particularly well versed. And yet he, again, on Newsnight got 10, 15 minutes, you know, and he gave evidence to a select committee. There are far better qualified people to be giving evidence to select committees and to be appearing on Newsnight for 10 or 15 minutes to try and talk about drugs policy reform. People who've worked in this area for years, for decades.
But so we're seeing the power of celebrity within the political system, and we've seen it in Hacktoff. We see it in the US all the time. The people who, just because they're famous, they get to have their say, and I think that that's really wrong, because they're just, you know, they're actors or they're very talented comedians or whatever they might be, but they haven't, as you said, they haven't got the background, they haven't done the research, and they haven't really thought through the ideas within the political system. They just chuck them in there and they expect everybody to listen and for us all to sort of, you know, take heed. And you know, you see it with Hugh Grant, you see it with all of these sort of people. It's like, well, fine, but, you know, earn your spurs like the rest of us have, delivering leaflets, knocking on doors, etc. And then you find out what people think, and then you know how what you think fits in with what they think. And that's what's important.
Yeah, and I think what also irritated me about that drugs thing is he was put up against Peter Hitchens, who is an I disagree with almost everything Peter Hitchens ever says, but he is an excellent debater. You know, he's been doing this for decades. He can muster a very, very good argument for whatever his position is. And then he's put up against Russell Brand, who wasn't taking the thing seriously and ended up just kind of, you know, laughing. And when he realised Hitchens was getting the better of him, he was just shrugging his shoulders and didn't really care. It's like, it's very sad to watch, really.
This is too important to not care. And that's the problem.
Yeah,
no, absolutely. And it is a real indictment of how we treat celebrity as if it's somehow more important than anything else that other people are able to do, to the point where we disenfranchise people. We don't listen to the experts. We listen to some random thoughts from some random bloke who happens to be famous. I think it's a worry that we're allowing that our system to become so degraded that's what's happening.
Yeah, and I think Charlotte's right. It does feel like the USA, you know, that's been happening over there for many years, and it does feel like it's getting more and more like that here. And I mean, I don't want to lay particular blame because I think it's a kind of cultural shift. But you know, I do remember the parties that Tony Blair threw when he first got in to Downing Street, and that did seem to herald a new era of taking celebrities far more seriously than they used to be.
Well, I don't know if that's true, because I remember both Labour and the Conservatives and the Lib Dems, in fact, having celebrities front stuff in the 80s. You had John Cleese all over the Liberals.
That's true, in the actually. 80s. Yeah.
Kenny Everett famously saying, "Let's bomb Russia" at a conference. So I don't think this is a particularly new thing.
Tracy Ullman with Neil Kinnock. Let's just do all three.
Okay. Yes, I was trying to think of a Labour one because I knew there were plenty, and I'd been to plenty of rallies in the 80s where there were where Lenny Henry was presenting something. I don't think it's particularly new, but I think that it used to be the case that celebrities were saying, "I support this politician." Now it seems they're supplanting the politicians, and that's where I think there's a real worry.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to another topic. One of the things that really struck me in the news this week, there was a huge hue and cry about a young girl in Greece who was a Roma child and was removed from her parents because they didn't think that she was, the authorities didn't think that she was their child. And then there was a second case in Ireland where a child was removed before a DNA test was done. Once the DNA test was done, it was then proved that the people who were called her mum and dad were in fact her mum and dad. And it struck me that anti-Roma prejudice has been allowed to overtake sensible policy making and sensible behaviour by the authorities. And obviously the front pages of all the papers when these two cases were first brought to light were, you know, shocking gypsies steal my children type headlines. And now, of course, that it's turned out that no such thing has happened, we're not seeing anything like the kind of same prominence of the retractions. Charlotte, what are your thoughts?
I think all of this is just desperately, desperately sad. You know, when you look at the background and the way in which these children are brought up, you know, where you have the brother, I think, of one of them saying, "I don't know if she's my sister. I don't know how many brothers and sisters I have." And you just think, goodness gracious me, this is happening now within Europe where a child doesn't know how many brothers and sisters they have. That is dreadful. And yes, they appear to at least be well fed, moderately. They're not thin or whatever. But one just wants something better for them. But one wants them to be with the family. And clearly some very strange things have been going on in terms of people keeping their children or not keeping their children, and they may or may not have given them to someone else to look after. That's not how you treat children, and that's not how family works.
Would you agree that if these incidents had been happening in families that were from a different ethnic background, then despite all of the conditions that we've talked about, and you know, I agree with you that there are real concerns about the individual children's cases, but they wouldn't have made the front page of the paper?
Well, I don't know. I beg to differ. I mean, I suspect that if this had happened in, say, the UK, in a community, and it doesn't really matter, you know, which one, within the UK, and this had happened, it would have made the front pages.
Well, children are taken into care fairly regularly, and then very few of them make the front pages.
No, but I think that this, you know, this was quite So I may agree with you; it may or may not have, but actually, I think it would have blown apart something much greater. I don't, I sort of, I've been thinking about whether or not this is an issue that people are saying, oh, well, the Roma people have been, you know, sort of persecuted for 12 centuries. It's not about that. It's actually just deep humanity, making sure that the way that the children are being brought up is sensible and it's not to their detriment. And actually, whether or not they're Roma is kind of irrelevant, but being handed from pillar to post, that's not how you bring up children. And we have a duty, I think, to intervene, or at least to express our displeasure at that sort of behaviour.
I mean, I think there are two issues. Sorry, Mark, did you want to come in on this?
No, carry on, Emma. I will in a minute, but go on.
I think there are two separate issues, one of which is the welfare of the children and the way that they are looked after, and the role of social workers, which is an incredibly difficult tightrope to walk between. Leaving children in a situation where you fear they may be harmed and taking children away. And the pendulum swings on a very, very regular basis between what should and shouldn't be done. And, you know, social workers always get it in the neck. But that's one set of issues. But there is also separately, I think, issues around the way these stories were reported, which I think were fueling anti-Roma prejudice and were fueled by anti-Roma prejudice. And, you know, the continued a culture where there is a real strong sense that this is a prejudice that people are allowed to have and it's OK to have. And, you know, it's not OK to be prejudiced in any way. And, you know, anti-Roma prejudice is severely damaging to communities and to those children.
But when is it prejudice, and when is it literally a concern for certain children within that community?
When you start assuming it's the whole community rather than individual families.
Right. I didn't particularly see that, but potentially, yeah, okay, you might be right. But I personally, from what I read, I didn't see that. I saw a particular family was held up and looked at, and it was found to be wanting.
Well, I think a lot of the reporting around it was about Roma rather than about those children.
Yeah, we've got all a bit, you know, got all a bit sort of urban and correct, etc. You know, the reality is there's children living in families which are very dysfunctional, and it's not fair on those children.
But there are children living in dysfunctional families that are not Roma, that are not getting this kind of attention. And that's where my issue lies.
Fine, okay, so let's go and find them, let's go and help them too. But, you know, to not then bring it out into the open, you're failing those children. Just because you can't help every single child doesn't mean you don't help any.
That child doesn't need to be on the front page of the Sun in order to be helped by social services.
Right, okay, so should we just trust the media up and make sure that they don't say anything in the future?
Well, I don't know whether we should shut them up. We should certainly call them out when they're speaking in a way that is prejudicial.
To whom?
Well, the Sun is being prejudicial against Roma people.
Hmm.
Against the Roma.
Well, I'm sure there'll be an authority somewhere that can make that decision.
Who are already suffering from quite difficult circumstances in general. They tend to be some of the most oppressed people across Europe.
Depressed or oppressed?
Oppressed people living across Europe, and you know, leading very difficult lives that are full of prejudices. People, you know, travellers' sites are never welcomed.
I don't know any travellers' sites in Greece and Bulgaria. I haven't been to either of them. But the simple fact is, you owe a responsibility to your family, and if you have 11 children and you can't look after all of them, you are not taking care of your family. That's terribly wrong.
Yeah, nobody is disputing that, Charlotte. What I'm disputing is the tone of the reporting around this individual case that has been stretched out to talk about a whole community. Mark?
A whole different issue, though, and that leads, you know, down to Leveson, etc. So,
yeah, I mean, I think I might pick up on that strand in a minute. I mean, I do think that the reporting of this has been prejudiced, frankly, and I do agree that there are children taken into care and children in, you know, difficult circumstances all around the country that do not make the front pages. It almost feels to me like prejudice against gypsies is one of the last kind of acceptable prejudices to have, certainly as far as the media is concerned. You know, there are ethnic minorities that the media wouldn't dream of treating in the way that they treat the Roma community. Mm. I think that says something pretty rotten about the media. And Charlotte, you just mentioned that, you know, that would be for other authorities to decide on. But that does come to Leveson because, you know, the PCC is a completely toothless tiger. You know, these kind of splashed headlines against Roma communities have been going on for years, for decades. And, you know, and it hasn't changed. It's pandering to the prejudices of the readership. And, you know, I don't see that changing. And I mean, it depends what eventually comes out of Leveson. And I believe on Wednesday this week, which I guess we'll talk about next week when the decision's finally taken, you know, some kind of new body is going to be formed. But I don't hold out any great hopes that things like that it's going to do much about things like this. Because, like I say, it is pandering to people's prejudices. Having said that, you know, if children are being mistreated or are being sold or, you know, passed around in a way that some people have alleged, then of course that's completely wrong and something needs to be done about it. But I very much doubt that it is just that one particular community in which bad things like this are happening. You know, if there are problems like that, it has to be sorted out, but it has to be sorted out everywhere and not made to seem like it is just one, you know, ethnic minority where this is happening, because that just blatantly is not true.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Charlotte, did you want to add anything?
Not without extending it for at least another half an hour. I'm now going to sit here and bite my tongue until it bleeds.
Well, that doesn't hurt too much.
To be fair, Charlotte, it is two against one. So.
Yeah, but I can deal with that.
Coalitious, that's what it is, Mark.
it's kind of anti-coalition, isn't it?
Okay, so let's move on to our third and final topic of the night, which is the remarks made by Grant Shapps today about the BBC needing to be much more transparent. Sorry, was it Grant Shapps or Michael Green? One of the two.
Oh, it started already.
Oh, don't go there. Just don't go there.
Well, when he's talking about transparency, I think it's fairly relevant. Grant Shapps talking about the BBC and how it should have the licence fee taken away if it doesn't massively change its institutional culture. Mark, Charlotte, I'll come to you first. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think he has a bit of a point, actually, unsurprisingly. You know, I do think that everybody pays their TV licence every year, and I think the accountability between the consumer and the BBC is somewhat opaque. And, you know, it's quite a lot of money that we pay. And as more of us, more of us watch things that are not BBC, I think they have a greater responsibility to the consumer. I think he's absolutely right to start calling them out. And it's not just the Conservatives who sometimes think that the BBC is a little bit biased. You know, one hears Labour saying this as well. So I just think it's about time that we say to the BBC, you are just too big. I mean, you know, however large they are. How many journalists do they have? 17,000 journalists, isn't that right? Something like that. It is about time that we looked at the BBC and we made it more accountable.
What does more accountable mean, Mark? Or Charlotte?
No, go ahead, Mark. I've done my bit.
Well, let me start by saying that the BBC is not perfect, in my view. There are problems with it. I mean, Charlotte just pointing out about how many journalists they have. One thing that drives me nuts is how whenever there's an important occasion, the BBC sends dozens, in some cases hundreds of journalists to cover the same thing. And when you look, it's journalists from Radio 4, journalists from Radio 5, journalists from Radio 1, journalists from the BBC, journalists from Newsnight, journalists from BBC Breakfast, journalists from local regional BBC newsrooms. And one of the things that some of the reforms that the previous Director General started to institute a few years ago was supposed to be to stop that sort of thing from happening, or to reduce it to have journalists reused across different platforms, which I think does happen a little bit, but it's still far too many. You know, when you look at these press conferences and you look at the people there, and sometimes a third or half the journalists are BBC journalists. That can't be right. You know, and there are other problems as well. I mean, I'm not happy with the way the licence fee is structured either. It feels to me like a form of poll tax. You know, everyone pays the same. And really, I am struggling as time goes on to justify that. You know, when the government tried to introduce a levy on telephone bills, I think it was going to be 50p a month, so £6 a year, and that was going to fund a rollout of fibre across the country to, you know, to have fast broadband. That was instantly derided as a poll tax, and eventually the government backed down and didn't do it. Well, that is like only about 3% of what the licence fee is, and if you're against the £6 levy on telephone bills for fibre, you really, if you're going to be consistent, should be against at least the structure of the licence fee. You might not be against the principle of it, but the structure of it I struggle with. And, you know, there are other problems as well. But having said all that, I think Grant Shapps is wrong in a lot of respects of the way he's gone about this today. I think the first thing is that, he tried to use the example of Jimmy Savile and Stuart Hall as a way of pointing out that the BBC have had problems with transparency in the past. Now, for me, that's reprehensible, because it's bringing it up in that way is starting to try and link what happened with them with the BBC in a way that is trying to almost make the BBC complicit in what happened there. And I think that is totally unfair. What you had with Savile and Hall is an entire cultural, societal problem to do with patriarchy and male power and power of celebrity and all of that stuff. And to try and somehow lay that at the door of the BBC as if it was their fault. You know, the BBC is just part of society. If Savile had been big in another field, in another area, like he was in hospitals, he was very big in hospitals, and he abused people there as well. You know, if he'd been big in another field, I think he was big in nightclubs in the 1960s, and I'd be amazed if he hadn't have abused his privilege and his power in those situations as well. So, you know, I think that is just completely wrong for him to do that. To talk about transparency, that's fair enough. But the BBC is one of the most transparent organisations that we have. I listen to the radio. They have this programme on Radio 4, Feedback. They're constantly examining themselves, beating themselves up. I mean, that's what happened with Newsnight with the Savile thing. You know, they didn't do the show initially, but then they had an entire programme where they dissected what they'd done and what they'd done wrong. It became quite meta in the end, you know, that's kind of self-referential. People were even saying the BBC is too navel-gazing. Well, you can't be both. You can't be opaque and also too navel-gazing.
Think that there's a central core of the BBC that ends up being very, very navel-gazing. The rest of it just carries on doing what it's done forever and with, you know, sort of declining audience numbers. And you just think, actually, hang on a second. I mean, you know, one of my bugbears is the extent of the BBC's digital organisation. It's massive. It's so enormous, and you just think, hang on a minute, why is the BBC producing different websites that are nothing to do with public sector broadcasting? It just has crept and crept and crept and grown and grown and grown.
Well, I think it depends what your definition of public sector broadcasting is. And, you know, it started with radio and then it became television. But in the last 10 or 15 years, the internet and online has become incredibly important. And, you know, all commercial broadcasters have a pretty substantial online presence as well. So it would be pretty strange if the BBC didn't also. You know, the BBC has to compete as well as, you know, with its public service remit. If suddenly the BBC just said, well, we're not going to bother having a website anymore, or, you know, we're not going to do anything. Okay, but we're not going to go into, because, you know, it's great when you're abroad. You can, if you want to know what's going on with the news in the UK, you just dip into the BBC News website and you know straight away you're getting relatively unbiased. I mean, I'm sure individual journalists within the BBC have their own political views. And, it would be naive of me to say that occasionally those aren't going to come through. But I don't think that is a serious problem at all. I think Grant Shapps seems to have picked up on Mark Easton, who's the BBC Home Affairs editor. He didn't name him by name, but the journalists who are interpreting what he said, I'm pretty sure that's who he means. And it seemed to be something to do with some immigration report that he claimed was wrong. But, you know, for every one of those, there'll be another one on the other side. You said yourself, Charlotte, that it's not just the Tories who complain about the BBC bias. Labour complain about it. Sometimes the Lib Dems complain. And one of the things the Lib Dems complain about is that, you know, they don't get a fair crack of the whip enough. Although since they've been in government, I think that's a bit less of a problem. But previously, you know, I think that the BBC can often be accused of maintaining this kind of red-blue duopoly that we have in politics, you know, kind of as if there's always two sides to everything. But I just think it's not a good idea for Grant Shapps to be wading in and, you know, putting this stick about and trying to somehow almost blackmail the BBC by claiming that this Royal Charter and there could be a problem with renewal if they don't book their ideas up. It feels very strange to me.
No, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, surely any one of our political systems, any one of our public services has to be, you know, told every now and again that actually you've got to buck your ideas up, because, you know, when I was I did some work with the BBC a few years ago, and they were about to spend £100,000 building a mental health website, and I just thought, what? Why are you spending all that money doing that? There's other people that do that. You know, there's an awful lot of money that goes to waste And actually, I'd like them to come back to their core of what they're doing. I think the BBC is fantastic. It is the periphery stuff that they do that is in danger of becoming irrelevant.
I think the BBC having a mental health services website would be a fantastic idea, actually, because it is one of the most trusted sources and somewhere where we can all go for information.
£100,000, this was not an
well
information attested, site.
Well, I don't know how much building a website costs, but I suspect that it is a very complicated area, mental health, and it probably does cost quite a bit to get that right. And actually having an organisation that is trusted enough to get it right probably helps a lot of people with mental health issues. I think that what the BBC, I mean, I agree that the BBC is not perfect in by any stretch of the imagination. But I remember being in America during 9/11 and watching American news journalism there and then switching to BBC America and the difference in quality and in the information rather than, you know, speculation was quite extraordinary. And it really gave me a fresh appreciation for how lucky we are to have the BBC. It is an extraordinary asset. It's something that, you know, around the world, people are envious of it because it is an incredibly strong brand. And I think, you know, we should be really, really cautious before we start tinkering with that on the basis of a political bias that simply doesn't exist, a lack of transparency that simply doesn't exist. And then, you know, there are problems with the BBC and everybody has a right to say, here's where I think those problems lie. But I think that Mark's right. I think this is Grant Shapps going too far into the territory of trying to cow our national broadcaster. And I, you know, I'm not in favour of that at all.
It's £145.50 a year. It is a lot of money. And I don't disagree with you as to how good the BBC is. I've lived in the States for 2 years and I was desperate for it. But that does not mean that you don't make them look at what they do and spend their money wisely.
I mean, you know, as Mark said, they are constantly, you know, most of the information about the BBC is fairly public. We're endlessly being told how much they're all paid. You know, this is information that is in the public domain and that the BBC itself reports on regularly. They do not have a transparency problem. Whatever other problems they have, they don't have a transparency problem.
Well, they clearly have a problem in the amount of money they paid off the payoff for the senior staff. I mean, that was absolutely outrageous, those
yes,
that
and
sort of
well,
money.
You know about that, and I know about that, so therefore they don't have a transparency problem. I agree that their structure is not always the best.
So what do you do next, then? What do you do next? They're being transparent. They're saying, we paid off our staff hundreds of thousands of pounds. So now what do you do, apart from say, hang on a second, if you keep doing this, we might look at the £145.50 you get from every single person in this country. Well, what else do you do? What are the ways have you got?
Well, Charlotte,
to face
I mean,
the BBC, buck up.
Charlotte, one of the things that I would do is look at the structure of the BBC Trust and the role of the chairman, which is currently Chris Patten, because I think that too often those bodies that are actually supposed to be arm's length and are supposed to be overseeing and critiquing what the BBC are doing are too they've gone native and they're too much defending and are complicit in you know kind of managerial decisions and kind of defending the BBC and that was never what they were supposed to do. So I think there's definitely a role for taking another look at that. And you know I'm the sort of person who quite happy to regularly review any organisation and make sure that they're keeping things up to date and that they're you know that they're not resting on their laurels and all the rest of it. But it just really sticks in the craw to have Grant Shapps coming along telling people they need to be more transparent. It really doesn't feel right. And it feels to me like he's doing it for electoral reasons, electoral positioning reasons. It's only 18 months from the next general election now. And I know that you know, a substantial proportion of people in the Tory base like to hear this stuff. They like to hear that, you know, the chairman's out there and, you know, complaining about political bias and put your ideas at the BBC because you never know what's going to happen with the charter in 2016. And it feels like he's doing it for those reasons rather than for any genuinely held reasons of wanting the BBC to be more transparent, frankly.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, because this is quite clearly political, because if it weren't, it would be announced by Maria Miller. Yeah, it's announced by the chair of the Conservative Party. Therefore, he's doing it from that position rather than from the position of being the person in charge of the BBC's role in an oversight by government.
So maybe he does feel that there is a greater political bias against Conservative Party than there is against any other party in the BBC,
he can
and,
feel that all he wants,
and quite right,
then,
in which case, Grant, shuts off you go. Call it out there. Call it out.
Well, I mean, he's wrong. The evidence points in completely the opposite direction, in fact.
I suspect that there is evidence in all different ways on this one.
Yes, there probably is, but the unbiased academic evidence shows that there are more Conservatives before the election and after the election who are called on to comment on stories than there are Labour people.
Unbiased academic evidence.
Yeah, it is.
Did you watch Question Time this week?
Sorry?
Did you watch?
No, I didn't watch Question Time this week. I very, very rarely watch Question Time. If I can.
Well,
possibly.
There we go then. That was quite fun. But, you know, I mean, you know, we can argue this till the cows come home, but the simple fact is that Grant Shapps had the balls to actually say something when most of the time people are just moaning on the sidelines. You know, and maybe the BBC will buck its ideas up. I hope it does. I think it's a great service and I enjoy it enormously.
I'm not sure having the balls to say something stupid and wrong is necessarily an admirable quality, but there you go. Mark.
Well, again, I feel
in
like
your opinion.
I feel like we're both ganging up on Charlotte, and it feels a bit unfair because I'm only really going to say what I've already said again. But I mean, longer term, I actually do think that in maybe another decade or two, there will eventually be quite substantial change with what the BBC is and what it does. I mean, you've only got to look at things like the iPlayer and, you know, the fact that there is just so much choice out there. And I can't imagine that the BBC will hold the kind of the majority. I mean, if you think about just how many different media channels they have across radio, across television, and now across digital, you know, is it something like 50-60% of the channels? I don't know. It's probably difficult to even measure that, frankly, given how it works now. But I can't believe that it's going to maintain that going forward. There are so many different ways for people to get the message out there. I mean, you know, if I think of some of the political stuff that I listen to these days, I still listen to, you know, stuff on Radio 4. But already, I mean, obviously, we've got the House of Commons podcast, which is, I think, the longest running independent political podcast in the UK. But also, you've got all kinds of other ones as well. It's the political podcast, The Spectator, do a fantastic one regularly every week now. The Telegraph has started doing one recently. You know, all these different channels of media and they're proliferating. And I can't imagine that the BBC is going to be able to hold itself against those in the long term. So, you know, I imagine there will be structural change. I just don't think structural change should come from, you know, Tigger getting on his high horse. But anyway.
Charlotte, last word to you.
Apart from the fact I'm going to have another bleeding tongue for 30 minutes that I could have gone on. I kind of agree with you a little bit there, Mark, because, you know, I think the proliferation of, you know, actually the atomization of the media environment that we have means that the BBC does have to go back and stick to its knitting and do the stuff it does really, really well and continue to do that. So, yes, the development of the iPlayer was brilliant. I think that, you know, news journalism is excellent. You know, I myself, as an insomniac, listen to the World Service every night. These things are very, very good. It's the extra stuff, the stuff that gets very, very, very low audiences, I mean, shockingly low audiences, that I think for people paying £145.50, I think that that's a real trouble. And I think we need to compare it a little bit to PBS in the States, where it's a whole, obviously, a very different model. But they do stick to their core, and they do certain things really well. They do natural history really well, for example. You know, that is where the BBC needs to be, and not trying to do absolutely everything.
Okay, well, thank you, Charlotte. Les said you'll have the last word, so I won't come back on that. But I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Can I also just apologise for your tongue, Charlotte?
Yeah, holes all over it now.
You can get a nice piercing.
At my age.
And why not? And on that bombshell, I'd like to thank Mark and Charlotte for joining me today, and also to thank Audio Boo for hosting the podcast, and Kevin McLeod at ecompetech.com for our funky theme music.